Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Although the word vitamins has been around for just over a century, the symptoms of vitamin deficiencies have been a blight on human health through the ages. Among them, swollen limbs, rotting gums, scaling of the skin, convulsions, suffocation, internal hemorrhaging, and a litany of other horrors. Today, essential nutrients are added to processed foods, and billions of dollars are spent on the almost entirely unregulated vitamin and supplement market. Journalist Catherine Price writes about the history, science, and beliefs surrounding chemicals manufactured and sold without any requirement to prove their safety, efficacy, or even composition. Her new book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. And Catherine Price, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So I just mentioned some of the diseases or symptoms of diseases like scurvy and rickets and beriberi. Why does the body need vitamins?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I've never heard anyone make internal hemorrhaging sound so cheerful. So that was kind of nice there. But yes, basically our bodies have evolved to need these 13 dietary chemicals that we know as vitamins. Which is an important clarification to make up front, is that the word vitamin is often used to refer to the much broader category of dietary supplements, which is basically like everything you see in the drugstore when you go into the supposed vitamin aisle. But these 13 substances, A, D, E, K, C, and the 8 B vitamins, our bodies do need. And what's interesting is that we may have originally been able to make some of these substances, including vitamin C, but for some reason, we've evolved to not be able to make most of these from our diet. So we need them in order to facilitate chemical reactions that keep our bodies running.
Now, there are so many foods that are fortified and enriched with vitamins. And you write about this as a convergence of two things, you know, an increase in processed food and a kind of magical thinking or belief in the power of vitamins. Can you kind of bring those two together for us?
Sure. So the first synthetic, by which I mean man-made vitamins, were created in the 1930s and 40s. And it was around the time that there also was a big increase in foods made from refined grains and a lot of processing going on. So the problem with the processing is that while it's necessary to have that kind of processing in order to have foods with long shelf lives, it also tends to destroy the vitamins and natural nutrients in that food. So that is part of the reason that fortification first started happening to the American food supply, was to make sure that these products wouldn't actually leave us in a state of deficiency. But at the same time, vitamins were enormously appealing to food marketers right from the beginning. So as you mentioned, the word was only coined in 1911, and that was actually before any vitamin had been chemically isolated. That didn't happen until thiamine in 1926. But even before then, you started to see food companies start to advertise the vitamin content of their products. And basically, it was just because, you know, vitamins, first of all, great word, fantastic marketing term. Mm-hmm. But second, if you give a vitamin to someone who actually has a severe deficiency, you actually will have miraculous results. If you give someone vitamin C who has scurvy, they'll get better. I mean, it's really pretty amazing. They are miracle drugs in that case. But, you know, what we did erroneously is to apply this idea of miracles beyond the purposes that vitamins are actually intended for and beyond the capabilities that they actually have.
Yeah, well, that was then when processed foods started being offered on the shelf. Now we have access to a wide variety of foods. But you found some research on what would happen even today if food were not enriched with synthetic vitamins. Like what?
Well, yeah, I found this fascinating. It was a 2011 paper that showed that a considerable percentage of the vitamins in the American diet actually come from these synthetic sources. And some of these things are they've been going on for so long, we don't even notice them. Like, for example, the vitamin D in milk is actually a synthetic addition. Milk does not have very much vitamin D to begin with. Or if you look at flour, most of our grain products are made with enriched flour. And when a flour is sold as enriched, it needs to have a particular combination of B vitamins, among other things. So it was very interesting to me to think that we like to think of our food supply as being so superior to everyone else in the world. But in reality, if you took away these synthetic vitamins, we would actually be at risk of nutritional deficiencies.
Mm. We get back to how we play shortcuts with nutrition, as you call it, this magical thinking. And you just made me think of this with vitamin D. Many people in the Northeast at this time of year have a vitamin D deficiency. So my doctor prescribes a sort of super dose of vitamin D. So you said, you know, a little bit of vitamin C will do something about scurvy. So our thinking is a little bit will do good, so a lot will be great. So does taking a super dose of vitamins actually help us?
I would say that that's not a good idea. And it is a very interesting tendency in terms of how we think of vitamins, that since a little bit is necessary and a moderate amount is not going to cause any immediate bad things to happen to you, then we assume that if we took a lot of a vitamin, then it must be able to do fantastic things for us. And that is, I think, a dangerous way to think about it. You know, for the most part, vitamins aren't going to hurt you in the short term, with the main exception being vitamin A, which can be toxic to your liver. But over a long period of time, having high levels of vitamins can mess up other other things going on in your body. Like, for example, vitamin D, if you were to take a true superdose of that for a long time, you might mess up how much calcium your body is absorbing and end up with deposits of calcium in places other than your bones, like your kidneys, where you don't want them. And the other thing about stuff like vitamin C, which is a water-soluble vitamin, so a lot of people will say, oh, it's totally safe, you just pee it out, no big deal. If you were to take really a lot of vitamin C for a long period of time, we don't really know what that would do to you. And so I think it's a much better idea to just try to stick to the doses of most vitamins that you could get in foods that naturally contain them.
I'm speaking with the journalist Catherine Price. She's author of a new book called Vitamania. It's about the history and science and oftentimes the belief, almost passionate belief, in the power of vitamins and supplements. She's done a lot of research on how they came to be added into our diet and whether they are indeed necessary. This idea that a superdose of vitamins will cure all ails, it reminds me of, you know those patent medicines back in the Victorian era, you know, Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup or Allen's remedy for corpulence or something. Those remind me of the claims that are made about what vitamins and supplements can do. Now, in the book, you trace the lack of regulation about vitamins and supplements to industry lobbying. When did this really begin in earnest?
Well, first off, I need to say the reason that Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup works so well and those patent medicines was often because they contain like cocaine and morphine. So they actually did
work
really
pretty
well.
It really did soothe.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, almost, you know, often too effectively. But in terms of supplements, they are regulated in the United States, but they are not regulated in the way that you and I would assume and the way that many consumers would want them to be, I think, if they knew more of the details. Basically, they are, as you pointed out, not required to be tested for safety or efficacy before being sold. And that is due to a law passed in 1994 called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which was written in large part directly by industry lobbyists, which forbade the FDA from ever requiring those things before supplements were sold. And what's particularly interesting about that law is that it was passed in large part with help of the American consumers, whom the supplement industry had convinced the American public that they might lose access to vitamins like vitamin C if the FDA were allowed to have its way. And the FDA actually did not want to try to take anyone's vitamins away. They were trying at that point to regulate health claims on supplement products. But it ended up being this perfect entree for the nascent supplement industry to get a much larger foothold and get this law passed that really took a lot of powers away from the FDA in ways that affect us today.
Mm-hmm. So the FDA effectively forbidden to compel supplemental makers to test products. And basically, they are required, however, to say that if you say on the label that something is in your supplements, it should be in there. And last month, the New York Attorney General ordered Walmart, Walgreens, Target, and GNC stores in New York to pull some store brand herbal supplements off the shelves. Now, this was after DNA tests showed supplements had little or none of the herbs listed. So how do we know if a vitamin or supplement is any good?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, unfortunately. In terms of the Attorney General report, it's an interesting situation in that it's not entirely clear that the correct tests were used for that. But it doesn't take away from the point that, as you just said, there actually are huge problems in the supplement industry about products not containing what they say they should. there are good manufacturing practices in place, which are supposed to require companies to ensure that what's in the bottle is on the label. But the last figure I heard is that the FDA was finding a rate of 70%, 70 of violations in the facilities that it inspected.
Wowie. So what kind of offenses would that be?
So in that case, it would be things like not having what it said on the label, not having the ingredients and the quantities said on the label, having other contaminants like heavy metals that weren't revealed or potential allergens, not dissolving properly, which obviously, again, getting back to our urine conversation, you want to have the supplement dissolve right. Otherwise, you're not going to get what's in it. And then just other labeling problems.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tell people to do if they really want to take dietary supplements, then I think that they should do their own homework. And that requires looking to a third-party organization who actually does test these things to check to see if what they have is what they say they have on the label. And, you know, one of those is consumerlab.com, which does a great job of pulling these things off the shelves and testing. Or you can look for a seal from USP Verified is the name of the seal, or NSF. And there's another company called labdoor.com that just came out.
When you talk about food in America, there's often this revelation of suspicion and divisions. I mean, I know plenty of people who turn their nose up at processed foods yet swear by synthetic vitamins and supplements with what I would compare to what you call in the book a kind of quasi-religious fervor. So, in other words, people who are rejecting industrial food and big pharma, but in some ways supporting big vitamins. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it is an interesting dichotomy there. You do have a lot of people who say, oh, I would never eat processed foods, but I take 30 supplements every morning. And that's interesting to me because in terms of the vitamin supplements, again, those 13 vitamins, those are going to be synthetic if they're in the pill and they're synthetic in food. And honestly, it doesn't matter that much for most vitamins if it's synthetic or naturally occurring. What's more important is the context. In other words, if you have a food that naturally contains a vitamin, like an orange and vitamin C, it's got a lot of other beneficial things in it that would not be replaced in a multivitamin. But it is kind of funny to me that we do have this kind of crunchy, all-natural feeling when it comes to dietary supplements and vitamins. And that is, I think, an erroneous perception to have because it actually is. It's a huge business. I mean, the latest estimates are $36 billion a year for dietary supplements, $11.7 billion of which are vitamins and mineral products. So it's not like someone just growing herbs in their backyard.
Mm. Did you take any supplements before doing your research for this book?
I had done a bunch of research on fish oil, I guess. Mm-hmm. So occasionally I took fish oil. I don't know. I'm not that into supplements. I try my best to eat a healthy diet. But I do think there's situations where supplements can be beneficial in terms of vitamins. I think it's impossible to give a blanket response to the question of whether or not we should be taking vitamins because it really depends on what else you're eating and whether or not you have an underlying medical condition that might require you to have extra.
Well, Catherine Price, a fascinating book. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Catherine Price, she's a journalist whose writing and multimedia work has appeared in several publications, from Best American Science Writing to The Washington Post. You can find much more on her book, Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection, including that list of sites that she mentioned that can help you determine whether you're taking the right kinds of vitamins. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.